You're listening to Next Level E-Commerce.
It's really a disruptive revolution that's happening right now. We should not underestimate what's going on here.
It all hits so fast.
And I just looked at them all and I'm like, this is it. This is like, I've made it.
I had a victim mindset. It's like, I only had one option.
Now I'm like the opposite. I'm like, F the hustle. I don't want to hustle ever again.
8 months before I sold my business, Amazon told me, we're going to shut down your account. You have 30 days.
If you really want to build generational wealth, leverage other people's money and continue buying, exiting, buying, exiting.
Each week, we feature inspiring stories from entrepreneurs who have taken their business to the next level. They share successes and failures and what kept them going when they felt like giving up. And here's your host, Isaac Smith.
Today, we're talking about everybody's favorite topic, acquisitions, and specifically, selling your business. I think almost all of us have thought about it. Some of us have done it. I sold my business about, a little over 3 years ago now. But I think this is something that when we're just starting out, we have it in our mind that someday if we do this right, we can have that exit that can be meaningfully life-changing. That's what we're talking about today. And with me, to join me in this conversation, I have Joe Valley. He's a partner at Quiet Light Brokerage, as well as the author of The Exitpreneur's Playbook, which is a great book, by the way, that goes really in detail all of the things that you're going to need to think through before you go out and list your business for sale with a broker or however you choose to do it. And actually, this is really cool. He's giving a free copy of the book to all listeners of the show. I'm actually looking at it right now. I've got it in my hands. So if you want a free copy, all you have to do is go to exitpreneur.io/next level. I'm going to have that link in the show notes, but again, it's exitpreneur.io/next level. You'll get a free download of the book, which I think is really cool that he's giving that out. By the way, before we get into it, one thing that you're going to hear us talk an awful lot about is when you're getting ready to sell your business, your numbers are, of course, absolutely critical. And you can read it in his book or listen to him talk. The first thing that you need to do is make sure that you have your numbers in order. So that's critical if you want to sell your business. Obviously, you can't if you don't. So if you would like to get your numbers in order, make sure that they're good and valid and trustworthy. I don't know if you know this, but of course, I have a company that does exactly that. Summit E-Commerce Advisors is my company that I run with my partner, Jason, and we do bookkeeping for e-commerce businesses. So if you want to get your numbers in order, so that you can sell your business one day and you want to do it with and you want it done by people you can trust, head on over to summitecommerce.co and you can get in touch over there. Likewise, send me an email, feel free, I don't mind. My email address is isaac@summitecommerce.co. Okay, so I hope that was enough preamble for you. I'm really excited about this topic and about this conversation. We're going to talk about, you know, the current environment for selling your business in 2022, as well as a whole bunch of other really cool stuff. So please welcome to the show, Joe Valley. Joe, welcome to the show. I'm really happy to have you here.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So it's we were just talking about how small the world is and yet how big it is. And I can't remember now how many people have referenced your book to me before we met. Two or three said it's really good. in...
I was really hoping for 200 or 300, by the way. That's yes. So disappointing of a number. I love the 2 to 3 people, though. They're, yeah. I've sent them money. You know,
we're yeah. Well, that's kind of my rule, actually. You know, if somebody recommends a book to me, I go like, okay, it's on my radar. But, you know, it doesn't go to, you know, toward the top of my priority list until at least a couple more people tell me about it. So that's 2 or 3 is like, okay, this is important.
I'm going to jump in and say something really weird. Yeah. I'm reading a book on vulnerability right now, which is a weird topic to talk about. But I, as you may recall, this book was launched last June of 2021, hit the bestseller list in 7 different categories on Amazon. One of them being multi-level marketing. I don't know why, but it is what it is. and so, you know, I had such high expectations for the book. I'm like, I'm going to crush my buddy Walker. Walker wrote Buy Then Build. He's sold about 40,000 copies in the last 3 years. He sells about 1,000 books a month now, which is considered a huge, huge hit. I'm like, I'm going to dwarf him. I'm only selling about 300 copies a month. It's picking up a little each month. Depends upon how many podcasts and all that other stuff that I do. And in so many ways, I feel like a failure because I wrote a best-selling book that's only selling 300 books in a month. But then when I look at it a different way, I'm like, 300 individual people thought I had enough important things to say to buy my book. And hopefully it's changing their lives and that'll continue to grow and get larger numbers. But yeah, it's weird. I'm a best-selling author, but nobody really defines what a best-selling author is when it comes down to numbers. No, it's weird.
That is funny. You know, it's like in the days of social media and, you know, smash success, screenshots, Shopify, right? Like, you know, how we define these things, especially, you know, quote unquote success is really, I don't know if it's a new topic, but it's acutely important in the entrepreneur's psyche these days, in a different way.
Yeah, the old saying, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. It has to be repeated over and over in your head. In this world, you know, when you look at a happy family on Facebook, you know, yet they're your neighbors and you know they fought the entire time they were at Disney. Or, like you say, somebody's standing in front of a Lamborghini showing their Amazon sales. I'm like, give me a break. Do not trust that person. But people do. People trust them. They believe that everybody else's life is better and happier. And they believe, you know, these quote unquote gurus are really selling stuff that's going to change their lives. I have the inside track to many of those quote unquote gurus because they've come to me to do evaluation of their business and sell it. And the numbers are horrible. The books are a mess, falling apart. And lo and behold, you know, we don't list it. Lo and behold, 6 months later, they're a guru traveling the country and the world, touting their expertise in e-commerce. It's kind of strange. Sorry, did I just open up with way too many cans here?
No, this is all about. So many directions we could go. We'll talk about your book later on. But I guess to start, how did you get into this business? So of course, Quiet Light Brokerage is a brokerage for online businesses, or is it just online businesses, or do you do offline?
100% online M&A firm. If there's a brick and mortar presence to the business, we generally tell them to go with a brick and mortar business broker.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. How'd you get into that?
Well, into this part of my life now, which is partnering with my original founder of Quiet Light, Mark Dowse. He founded the company in 2007. I joined the company in 2012, Isaac, after I sold my own e-commerce business through it in late 2010. At the time, it was Mark Dowse and Diane, part-time help, and Jason Yellowitz. Mark founded the company in 2007 after selling his own e-commerce business and going, you know what? There's a market for this. My neighbor asked me to help sell his business. So he said, I'll give it a try. And he did. So he founded Quiet Light. But he hired As he tried to grow, he hired salespeople to help them. And I know I'm telling Mark's origin story instead of mine, but I'll get to mine. Eventually, it never really worked. And Jason came along, who's a very successful entrepreneur, raised a lot of venture cap money during the dot-com bubble just before it, of course, lost it all. Very, very successful person, though. He said, listen, you shouldn't have salespeople be brokers. You should have entrepreneurs help entrepreneurs exit their business and focus only on the online stuff. Jason was the first advisor in that new model, and he was my advisor back in 2010. I spoke to Mark in early 2010. He said, listen, man, you should wait. Your numbers are coming right back up after the Great Recession. If you wait another 6 months, you're going to make an extra $100,000. I thought, who the hell is this guy telling me to go away? Whereas the other brokers that I talked to, two of them were just trying to get their hooks into me for a commission. I waited. I thought, I got to work with these guys. Jason sold it. And, you know, we had it under LOI in 3 weeks. And back in November of 2010, I took 11 off. And then I joined the team in 2012. And it was still just Jason and Diane part-time and Mark, the original founder. I joined. And then shortly after, Amanda Robb joined. And for the next, 2012 till 2015, 16, right up through 17, I ended up in some years closing up to 70% of all of Quiet Light's transactions. Mm. And then we needed to grow and make it beyond me in case I got hit by a bus. And so I started bringing on new advisors and training them. And by the time 2017 came around, I was in the fortunate position of saying to Mark, listen, man, I'm used to having equity. I don't want to do this anymore unless I have equity. So we worked out an arrangement officially in January 2018. We became partners. And honestly, I looked at our growth trend the other day, and because my wife was saying, you got to give yourself more credit. You got to give yourself more credit. And because the revenue was kind of bumping along here and there from, you know, 2012 to 17. In 2018, man, it took off. You know, we closed in 2021, we closed 210 million in total transactions. And that's with 40 million falling apart in December and getting bumped to January. So we would have hit $250 million in transactions in one calendar year. Wow. That is up 80% over 2020, which was up again and again. So we've grown 85% a year on average for the last 4.5 years. It's just been a crazy ride. And now there's 15 advisors all together, fully focused on the online M&A world. And so how did I get to where I am? I sold my last e-commerce business to Quiet. I joined the team, earned my way into equity. I was ready to stroke a check. Isaac, I tell this to Mark now, I'm like, you didn't ask for any money. I'm like, I was ready to write it. He just gave me equity and then I earned more and more. He's 60, I'm 40, laid out there. Prior to that, entrepreneur all the way. I've been self-employed officially as an adult since 1997. Prior to that, I couldn't really hold a job for, I think the longest I was employed was, I joined a company called Talk America in 1994, and that was the longest job I had. I left there in the summer of 97. So that's only 95, 96. That's 3.5 years, right? That was the longest I ever held a job. And I was 29 years old at that time when I left. Mm. And I left because it was an amazing company when I first joined. I was employee, I think, number 34, and that counted like a lot of people on the sales floor. Once I got beyond being a sales rep on an inbound call center floor, it was a direct response marketing company, radio and television ads coming into it. And, I used to try to be the first in to work and the last to leave when it got to the management level when I was in the management side. But I am an entrepreneur and always have been, even since I was a little kid. And it got to the point where I had to leave because I was going to get fired. you know, I saw people get promoted to their level of incompetence and could not keep my bloody mouth shut. and decided at one point I needed to move on. And I'm going to just resign from my position here, and I'm just going to go back on the sales floor and take, you know, work my own schedule and whatever. And HR quickly came in and said, this guy named Wolf, his name was Wolf. He was a tree hugging, meditating, weird guru that I really, really liked. And all those things are positive things about him. And he came and he said, who the hell do you think you are? We all know you don't like Jennifer, and she's the head of the sales team. And yet you think you're going to go ahead and then go work under her? And he's like, I'm sorry, Joe. Pack your bags. I got to walk you to the door. And this is after I resigned. And then they called me in while I was on my vacation. And I resigned from my management position. They called me in when I was on my vacation. I said, I'm on vacation. I'm not coming in. And then I go back in. I said, you can't go back on the sales floor. So I guess maybe I still like to say I resigned before I got fired, but I guess that's technically walking me to the door, isn't it? Do I have to change my story now? Because maybe I did get fired.
You know, I was an architect before I figured out I didn't want to work for other people. Mm-hmm. And I worked for one firm that was just toxic to the core, like just disgusting. And it was, I was just completely miserable. They were, I mean, 90 hour weeks, not exaggerating, you know, like all kinds of stuff. And I had a baby at the time, you know, wanted to spend more time at home, and just completely miserable. And like, I can't take this. And so I remember like, and at the same time, that was 2009, I think 2010, she was born. And, you know, that was not a good time for the economy, especially in the construction industry, which architecture is a part of. Right. So it was like, man, there's nowhere to go here. And I thought like, I just can't keep it up. And my dad told me, don't, whatever you do, don't let them fire you. If you're going to lose the job, actually, I don't remember if he's the one who said this. He said a lot of things like this. Don't let them fire you, because that's, well, for many reasons, but if that's going to happen, make sure you quit first. Because you think maybe it'll be okay, but that is, being fired is quite a burden to carry around.
You have to explain that. If you're going to go and get another job, I think so. But if you're going to, you know, jump into the entrepreneurial world, it's a badge of honor, right?
I
had goals when I was exiting Talk America. Mm-hmm. And look, Talk America was a great company at one time. When I joined it, it was amazing. I loved it. I would want to be the first in and last to leave. And then by the time we got to the end, it was just a bunch of worker ants farming, you know, marching in and marching out at the end of the day. We went from, you know, I was employee number 34 in January of 1994. By the time I left in September, late August, actually, of 97, we had over 1,000 employees. Wow. And we'd gone from something like 17 million in that first year to 105 million in revenue that last year. So it was wonderful and painful all at the same time, but I learned an awful lot.
Yeah.
And I took some of the skills that I had there, and I started my own company. And, you know, the key thing is, you know, I've got a nephew that's 20 years old now that has an entrepreneurial bug. And I said, look, Jonathan, when I launched my first company, forget about my first successful company, forget all the ones that failed. We won't even talk about these right now, but when I did that, and it was called JVI Media, it was, you know, a full-time gig during the day, 50, 60 hours a week, trying to get it off the ground. I was also working at another call center at nights and weekends, making ends meet. I was working another 40 hours a week. And I did that didn't have to do it for more than maybe 5 or 6 months, but it's just part of the process that you've got to do as an entrepreneur, if you can, right? When you did it, you had a baby, you had a mortgage probably.
Yeah.
I lived in a two family that I bought, and the tenants in the front paid, you know, the mortgage. So I was debt free.
Man, that's smart.
My student loan. Yeah. No, I had that as a goal all along as a kid, you know. I wanted to have some real estate that I could help me get off the ground. That first property needed to be something that was not a burden, but more of an income stream and building some equity. And it did. And it was great. And it got me off the ground in terms of entrepreneurship. Yeah.
I think about this a lot. Young people coming up, whether they go to college, whether they go right into the workforce. And, you know, if you are going to be on that path of entrepreneurship, it's really good if you have some skills that translate. I tell you, architecture did not really translate very well. I mean, sure, there's some things that I took with me, but of course, all in hindsight is like, wow, that was a jarring shift.
Yeah, but let's give you more credit though, because, you know, studying architecture is one of the most rigorous course loads that you can have. My oldest is studying industrial design at NC State, and we talked about architecture, and we talked to the students, and we talked to the professors. I mean, that's a lot of work. Not only did you have to have a great work ethic to get through that and survive and graduate, but then you took a job where you're working 90 hours a week. That is something that translates over into your new life. You can be very efficient with your time, you know, or you think, oh, I've got 90 hours. Hopefully you didn't work 90 hours a week when you first started the business, but it's a work ethic thing that you develop through college because of the course load and the niche that you studied. So I would give yourself credit for that. Did my accounting class translate into what I do today? Not really. I fell asleep in accounting class. Did my finance class? No, I don't think so. Computer programming? No, I think college is a time to grow up, mature, step away from the cocoon of home, but still have that safety net, and to really learn about what you don't want to do more than what you do want to do. I went to Northeastern University with a co-op program, and I tried so many different things. I'm like, yeah, okay. I was at a mutual fund company. I got my Series 6 and 63. I know I don't want to do that, so let's just put that away. And I kept trying different things. And I think that people need to do that in life. It's amazing how you go off to college at 18 and go, I'm going to be an architect for the rest of my life. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
That's what they make us do in this world, though.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about that. I could talk about that forever, but I want to transition over to, I want to briefly ask, just for some context, what was your business that you sold in 2010 or 2011?
Yeah, it was called, it was purestat.com. It's not there anymore. Purestat is a made up word. And it was a digestive wellness center is what I turned it into, Isaac. Supplements, nutritional supplements.
Ah, okay.
What it started out as in 2002 was a colon cleansing product. It was probiotics and cascara and a couple of different things like that. And I did a radio campaign and a television infomercial, and then took it 100% online in 2005. And I met with a website developer who said, look, all you got to do is just keep writing content and Google will reward you. I'm like, it's a colon cleansing product, David. How much can I write? And he was right though, because we just, you know, we ended up with about 300,000, you know, organic visitors to the website every month by the time I was done in 2010. And it's because we turned it into a digestive wellness center, from liver cleansing and everything from the mouth to the anus we wrote about.
Wow.
Literally, we wrote about the anus too.
Wow.
Yeah, so, we won't go too deep in there, but...
You won't go too deep into the anus. So, okay. One thing that strikes me is... Huh?
Awkward pause. Sorry. Everybody in the audience is going, David, you know, Isaac just didn't know what to say to that.
we got anus talk here on the podcast. So one thing that I'm very curious about, just in general, we're going to kind of skip ahead or skip sideways for a bit, is economics and the waves that come. So for example, I'm reading all kinds of books, like right here is this book called Generations. It's about the cycles of history and how the generations shift over time and attitudes and all of this. And I'm thinking, like, okay, we're in crazy times now. If we look out to see what are the waves that are coming, and then how can we put ourselves in position to surf these waves? And where the wave pushes you, right? You're, of course, you have some work to do to stay on the wave, but you're not out there like struggling to just get to shore. And interesting, like there's some waves. E-commerce has been a wave, right? A big surge over the last couple of years. And then, of course, all the tangential things that attach to that, right? Services, SaaS products like Shopify, or, you know, any of the apps that go on to Shopify, buying and selling of these things. But there's other waves too. So I'm wondering if you look at this, you know, I don't know if you caught a wave with your supplement business, or now how you look at that with, you know, the M&A space with e-commerce and with other types of online business. But
yeah,
do you think about this?
Yeah. So when I had my supplement business, I think the tide was very low, right? Mm. Because nobody was really buying or selling online businesses at the time. People started to buy products online, but certainly not at the level we're at today. And so when we jump to Quiet Light, I often describe that we are at the tip of a rocket ship. And we are, we've got it wrangled, right? We've got a leash around it, and we're holding on tight and trying to steer that ship that is actually, you know, the Quiet Light ship. But the fuel is everything else that is happening in the online world, people buying in the digital world. And everybody says, well, what's your prediction for 2022? You know, the market, stock market's going to struggle. It's down 10% this year. Interest rates are going to go up, pandemic, all this other stuff. And I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, and multiples have climbed a lot as well, as you know, in the last couple of years. I still think we're at the absolute tip of the iceberg of what's going to happen in the online world. And, you know, you and I both have gray hair on our chin, and we're in this world. If you go back a decade ago, honestly, it was people and the industry, just a bunch of quote unquote kids messing around, trying to figure this out and taking shortcuts to build these online businesses. Many of them taking a lot of shortcuts, right? That's what the Penguin update was, the Penguin update, Panda update, iOS update, all of them. And so the people that survive and thrive in this world are building better businesses that are going to just legitimize, you know, what we have. And the values are going to continue to climb, in my opinion. Yes, there'll be hiccups here and there, but I think that the future is incredibly bright for anybody in the online world. Yes, it's harder, right? It's not as easy. When I first started buying media in the online world, doing Google AdWords, it was like 10 cents a click for the word colon cleanse. By the time I finished in 2010, it was probably $3, right? It's ridiculous how much it went up. And I'm sure it's $15 now. It's just stupid money. It makes it harder, but the people in it have to be smarter. And because they're smarter, they're building better businesses. And that makes investors really, really interested. And that's why the multiples are climbing, because it's less of a risk. It's where we have billions of dollars of PE money buying up Amazon businesses. It's not because the sky is falling and Jeff Bezos is going to change everything and no third-party sellers are going to be on Amazon anymore. It's because they believe that these are investments that they can make to get a positive return on their investments. And it's, I have to say, I think they're right. You know, it's the same safety it was 4 years ago, but now that everybody's doing it, the multiples have climbed. So I think the future is strong for content SaaS, e-commerce, agencies that are servicing all of these people that are trying to, you know, sell their wares on Amazon and Shopify and other platforms. I'm not the sky is falling Chicken Little type of thing, even with interest rates rising, even with, you know, political fiascos here and there. I do think about 2024, though. I'll be honest with you about that, about 2024 and what's going to happen politically, you know, with just clashes and civil wars and stuff like that. Maybe that does concern me, but everything else, not so much.
Yeah. It's not something we have much direct control over, you and me.
Not at all.
So I'm curious now, you and I have been talking about e-commerce. How much of Quiet Light, I'm sure you work with all types of other online businesses. Mm-hmm. Is e-commerce, is it the most popular or the most take up the most, what you call it, businesses listed or?
Yeah. So I just looked at this the other day. If you think about it, a lot of people need e-commerce defined, it's selling a physical product, right? E-commerce is electronic commerce. It's physical products, but then you've got SaaS, software as a service,
right,
service agencies, and then content where you're earning money through ads and affiliate links and Taboola and things of that nature. E-commerce represented about 68% of Quiet Light's total $210 million in transactions in 2021. And of that, about 50% of it was a majority Amazon-based business, okay? Mm. Which I think is funny because you and Ben Leonard were saying you hate it when people say I have an Amazon business.
Yes.
Yet, there are people doing, you know, $50 million in revenue annually on Amazon.
Yeah,
that's a hell of a business.
Yeah.
There are people that, you know, started with nothing, bootstrapped a business, went for the Amazon side of it, and 36 months later sold it for a couple of million dollars. That to me very much feels like they had a business. They were serving someone, providing products, services, better in their lives, and then got rewarded for it as well. It feels like a business. So I would love to, you know, discuss that further with you and Ben at some point. But, you know, when you talk to these entrepreneurs, they're running a business. They're doing absolutely everything everybody does, you know, with managing cash flow and employees and ads and everything else, even if it's just 80% of the revenues from Amazon, it's not all that different. It's still a business. They own the seller account. Yes. Yes. Amazon could kick them off, but only if they break the rules. The same thing would happen if they're on Facebook or Twitter or Shopify, and, you know, their merchant provider is going to shut them down because the chargebacks are too high and all that good stuff. So it's still a business. And I know you didn't want to go down that path of that tangent, but here I go answering your question with a tangent. So it's, would we at Quiet Light prefer that, you know, we were 50% e-commerce and then the other 50% SaaS and content? Yes. It's just the nature of the world that we live in, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Or fortunately, I'm not sure. You know, content businesses, touching on that. So those are amazing. Love to sell those. There's just not enough great ones that come along. Mm-hmm. But when they do, they sell very quickly at a very high multiple because the margin's amazing. If somebody's doing $1 million in revenue on a content site, their discretionary earnings is probably $800,000 or $900,000. Whereas if they're doing $1 million in revenue on a Shopify store or a combination Shopify Amazon, their discretionary earnings is probably in the $150,000 to $250,000 range. And they need lots of working capital for it as well.
Yeah.
Which would you rather own? I don't know. They're both hard to start. Content takes a long time to get off the ground and get going. It's it's not as easy to buy media and you get traffic. It's you write content and hopefully you get rewarded over time. You got to be patient there.
I was talking about this with an e-commerce business owner just a week or two ago. And he was telling me, man, I'd love to get out of the customer service business, you know, of e-commerce. I'd love to get into a more, I guess, content focused business. And, you know, whether that's acquiring something or building up from scratch, you know, we were having this conversation and that sounds great to me. You know, there's less capital involved. Exactly like you said, the margins are higher, so you don't need to, you know, $1 million in revenue means something entirely different.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, now that we brought this up, that sounds great to me, but I also know that the grass is always greener, but when you get over there, it's not. So yep. Do you have a perspective on this?
Yeah. If you've got a single content business that you're relying on for your livelihood, you're at risk. Just like you have a single SKU on Shopify or Amazon, it's a higher risk than having a half a dozen or a dozen SKUs that you're selling. There's a guy named Ewan Finzer that I've known for a number of years. I had him on the Quiet Life podcast. Ewan launches 100 content sites at a time.
Wow.
He picks a topic, blue couches, and whatever, you know, silly headphones or whatever. Very niche-oriented content sites, right? He's not looking for huge numbers. He's very niche-oriented, but he will launch 100 of them, and he's got a flywheel of writers that they pick and choose what articles they want to write. And I take it back. I think maybe it's 25 content sites, but he writes 100 articles for everyone and then just launches all of them at once. And then he sits back and he waits 18 months to see which ones actually work. Right. Mm. It's an interesting concept. And he said to me, he goes, you know, I decided to launch them instead of buy them, because when you buy a single content site, it's an incredible amount of risk. There's so many things that could go wrong with it. I bought a content site after I sold my e-commerce business in 2010. I bought a content site on March 1st, 2012. 42 days later, the Penguin update hit. And this content site that was called InTexasAutoInsurance.com was doing, you know, $10,000 a month in easy money, right? In terms of profit. It had 6 links on page 1. All of them wound up on page 2 after the Penguin update, and then 3, 4, 5, and 6. I lost $280,000 in 10 months because of poor link building practices. So if you're going to get into the content site as an acquisition entrepreneur, you better know your stuff in terms of due diligence and studying whether or not the site is built well. What's the domain authority? Where are the links coming from? Mm. Some people will lie, cheat, and steal, even though we now have gray hair on our chin. You know, you've got to make sure that absolutely everything that drives traffic to that site transfers. So Ewan would say, no, in hell am I buying a single one, even though he's bought a single one from me before in the past. He's just changed his mindset over the years. I have done it and I totally screwed up, right? I sold a great e-commerce business that was really a content business that happened to sell products. Mm-hmm. And all I did was write good quality content over a 5-year period. And Google did reward me. But I was too stupid to really understand the true value of that. And I woke up tired one day and decided to sell my business. It's there. I think that if you it's still a business and it's still the grass, you know, like you said, the grass is greener. You still have to think months and months and months in advance about writing the content and understanding SEO and building audiences that you can reach out to and gaining email addresses so you can launch maybe products or new things. And it's still a business and it still takes time to operate. So I wouldn't say it's right for everyone. You know, some people I know have switched to content completely. The largest content site I ever sold was just under $9 million. It was a soap opera website. All they did was write content about the daily soap operas every single day, multiple times a day. I sold it for just under $9 million. The person that bought that runs an e-commerce business now. Go figure, right? He runs a pet-related e-commerce business, and he's hoping to sell it for $100 million someday. He never would have sold that content business for $100 million. Just wouldn't. That's scalable. But now that he's selling dog food, that's scalable. And he's hoping that's the difference in terms of goals and whatnot too. So you have to really understand who you are, number one, and what you're capable of personally, so you don't promote yourself to your own level of incompetence. And you got to be happy about what you do as well, right? So as I told you earlier, my son is 18 years old. He's a track athlete. It's his senior year in high school. The first track meet of the season was yesterday, and he just set the school record for indoor track. It's the It's the first event he's run, and he set the school record. I'm excited for what's going to happen in the next 5 months. I'm going to make sure that I have that life work balance, and I put life first, as you noticed, so that I don't miss the next 5 months. Because he could have pulled a hamstring last night, and then there'd be no more events. And if I missed that, I didn't see any of it. So you got to really know what your level of incompetence is, but really look inside and determine what you're happy with and what drives you. Right? We can all get caught up in this world of entrepreneurship, and you say to yourself, "I can do that," and you just, because you can, doesn't necessarily mean you should. I could do lots and lots of things, but at the end of the day, I'd probably be miserable just because I wanted to prove to somebody that I could. I don't want to. And that's the benefit of age, is that you've screwed up lots and lots in the past, right? I just told you a story where I lost over $250,000. I've done that in real estate too. And you learn from that, and you get smarter about that, and you get less reactive about things, and you prioritize your business and your life to have you a little calmer and a little happier day to day than, the highs and lows that we all get from entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I like that. It makes me think, like some businesses people are suited to more than others. And since you brought it up, Amazon, not Amazon, some people are suited to that and some people, are less. So yeah, well, I've always loved to have this discussion.
I want to say one thing, cause I want people to really think about this. So you really truly have to figure out what you're good at and what makes you happy, the combination of the two. And sometimes it's hard to do. And sometimes as you age and grow and mature, you evolve and those things change. But when I look at that first business that I started, Isaac, it was a media buying agency. So I was in the middle. I was spending other people's money. I'd buy $100,000 of media for Dan, and then it would go to Rob's call center. So Dan was really dependent on me buying great media, and Rob was too, because I had to buy quality media. And these are real people. Dan and Rob would fight every week, and almost the whole thing would almost fall apart every week. My job was to be in the middle, not just to be a great media buyer, but to manage both of their emotions and expectations. And I just realized this the other day. Fast forward to my role at Quiet Light, I'm in the middle of transactions between buyers and sellers, and my job is to manage their emotions and expectations. That's not what the job description says.
Yeah.
That's the most important role of the job. And so now I know that I'm pretty good at that stuff. I like it. It helps. It changes their lives. What I would want the audience to do, and you as well, is to look back at what you really like to do, what drove you, what got you excited, and what you could do that would last. And just because your buddy John is killing it selling products on Amazon doesn't mean that that's right for you.
Yeah.
There's too many of that. Hey, he's doing it. I should do it too, kind of thing.
Well, it's interesting you say this. You had this realization for yourself. And actually, over the last year, I've had a similar type of realization for myself. And this can all be wrapped up into an Amazon conversation, because the way it will fit in just a minute. I have realized over my course of ups and downs in entrepreneurship. There are some things that I'm good at, pretty good at, maybe even really good at. And there's a lot of everything else that I'm just not good at. And some of these things I can force myself and do adequately, but not in a way that's going to be explosively, it's not going to generate explosive growth for anybody. But, you know, maybe it's done okay. And what I have learned is the things that I'm good at are bringing a vision to someone and getting someone real, you know, finding someone who fits within a vision, bringing that excitement and saying, hey, let's go do this together. And like putting us all in a direction, like, apparently I'm good at this. But what I'm not good at is what I've started to call the mechanisms of marketplaces. So like eBay, Amazon, and Shopify is not a marketplace, but you list your products on places usually, you know, whether it's Google Shopping, that's kind of a marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you're in a marketplace, there are keywords, bids, photos, you know, you have things that you're optimizing in relation to other things, you know, generating sales, you know, like, or simply determining demand for a specific product, how, you know, like, I'm really not good at that.
Yeah, I'd be terrible at that myself. I would have to delegate that.
Yeah, and I'm miserable. It makes me miserable. And I spent years trying to get good at that. And you know, eventually I had a business that was okay. But I see these marketplaces as mechanisms. And especially early on, like I don't know, maybe 2015, 2016 was like the Amazon mechanism glory days, where if you could follow these formulas, these algorithms that were promoted by people like the amazing, what is it? Amazing Selling Machine. And, you know, everybody else who was selling Amazon courses, right? They're essentially their own algorithms and mechanisms and levers that you can pull to generate something out the bottom of this machine. That stuff I'm just terrible at. But so maybe I shouldn't be doing that. Anyway, so I think that's like, maybe it's my own personal aversion, or if you want to say perspective or bias. To me, that seems like a mechanism rather than a sustainable business. And I know people, like you're saying, people have built large businesses off of Amazon, and I'm not trying to discredit that. But
well, you know,
that's my background.
You know, the language I heard was, "You don't have an Amazon business. Only Jeff Bezos has an Amazon business." Well, that would be saying like,
right,
I have a Shopify business. The point is,
I wouldn't say that either.
Right. Well, I wouldn't either. I would say I own an online business. But nobody has a Shopify business. The founders of Shopify have that. You know, I think the mechanism part is true, right? Amazon, the platform of Amazon is a mechanism in which your business generates revenue and profit.
Right.
Same is holds true for eBay, Walmart, Target, and all of these third-party selling platforms, right?
Right.
But if your business is doing 80% of its revenue through Amazon, by default, you really have what I would call an Amazon business or an Amazon platform business. You still have a business, and what you're doing is selling most of your wares through that particular platform. You know, they still have a business. There's no question about it. They just happen to be doing most of their revenue on Amazon. But they're real businesses, I guess was my point. They're absolutely real businesses. And we are, I mean, we've sold them for upwards of $25 million, Isaac.
Yeah. You know, that's not real.
that's pretty real. Yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. I know you are. I know you are. I know. And you know what, even, you know, some of my favorite businesses are not those big ones. You know, I sold a business for a woman. Her name was Lee Huyen, H-U-Y-H-N. And she came over to this country from Vietnam when she was 15 years old with her two sisters and mother. None of them spoke English. They had $300 to their name and a family took them in. Fast forward to when she was 34 years old. So what is that? 19 years later, I sold an Amazon business for her for $750,000. So that's it is the American dream.
That's awesome.
Right. And yeah. it's being accomplished because someone else said, I'm going to try this American dream thing and I'm going to leave the investment banking world. I'm going to start this little book selling business. You know, I'm going to call it Amazon. And here we are today, you know, with what, 2 million people selling their wares on Amazon, and it's changing my life. In the pandemic, it's changing people's lives because my father shops online now and he goes to Amazon. Mm-hmm. Right, he doesn't go down the street to the grocery, wherever he would go. It's just, let's not cut on Jeff Bezos too much because he really has changed the world that we lived in.
Oh,
but
yeah,
but that's not what you were doing. So I'm just talking to everybody else that criticizes all over Twitter.
Okay, yeah, we can talk about billionaires and capitalism angrily on our iPhones. So before we run out of time, I want to get your perspective on the state of the market. And I told you before, I get a lot of people coming to me saying, hey, I know you talk to people. What should I want to sell my business. What do you think about that? So I have these conversations all the time. And they're all e-commerce business owners. What are you seeing in the world out there for e-commerce?
First, I would say that, you know, when someone says, I want to sell my business, what do you think? I think that selling a business is a very personal, individualized decision, right? Because if you have reached the end of your, you know, end of the line for you in terms of that the business that you're running, and that happens when you are an entrepreneur, you can only take it so far before you have to move on to your next adventure. If you're there, then hopefully you've prepared for that. You didn't wake up and decide to sell your business, right? If I woke up and I decided to sell my business in spring of 2010, and if I had gone with the two Yahoos that were just trying to get their hooks into me for a commission, I would have sold it for $100,000 less. It wasn't a big sale back then. Well, it wasn't a big sale by today's standards. It was a big sale back then. But I waited another 6 months because somebody told me, smarten up, Joe, prepare. So first, I would say to anybody that is wanting to sell their online business, what are your goals? Have you set any goals? How much do you want to sell your business for in dollars, not multiples? Mm-hmm. When do you want to sell it? And by the way, how do you want to feel when you sell it, right? Are you selling it because you want to retire? Are you selling it because you just need to move on? You've taken it as far as you can. And you know, you need a team of 20 people to take it to the next level. And that's not your thing. How do you want to feel? Unburdened? Like, I've asked people this, I've sold their business. This guy, Joe Cochran, great guy, got his girlfriend pregnant 2 days after his 17th birthday, right? And he still graduated high school, is still a dad to that son, has gone through rehab and bankruptcy and came out the other end. And I sold an online business for him for $2.5 million. And I asked him when it was done, I was like, how do you feel? He says, man, I just feel unburdened. Unburdened. I was so stressed. It was getting so much bigger than I wanted it to be. And I'm taking the next year off going fishing. He runs another e-commerce business now, but he was able to do that. So set a goal. How much do you want to sell the business for? When do you want to sell it? And how do you want to feel? And then be smart. Reverse engineer a path to that goal. And in order to reach that goal, you need to know where you are today in terms of its value, right? If you want to sell it for $5 million and add or subtract zeros, people, to suit your business, if you want to sell it for $5 million, but you're doing $100,000 in discretionary earnings today, and you're hoping to sell it next year, you're not going to. That's the reality. But if you're doing $1 million in discretionary earnings, or let's say you're doing $750,000 in discretionary earnings today, but your goal is to sell it for $1 million 12 months from now, you're pretty close. You're getting close, but you really have to understand what buyers are looking for, what pull, you know, what pushes and plummets value, risk, growth, transferability, and documentation. And then you got to behave online. If you go spouting Trump hate or Biden hate all over social media, guess what? You just lost 50% of your buyers.
Mm.
Sorry, you needed to behave and be a good person, because trust is the most important thing, you know, in terms of the transferability of the business for the best price and the best structure, meaning all cash, right? The more people trust you, the more likely they're going to give you the best value and best deal structure for your business. So selling a business is very individualized. If someone wants to sell it, and the question is, what do you think? It's a long answer.
Yeah. I always ask people what specifically, extremely specifically, are you going to do with the money? Because if you're going to get the money and it's just going to sit somewhere, maybe you haven't thought this through. What do you think about that?
I think more often than not, it's not necessarily about the money.
Right. It's never. It's always like you were right to touch on the emotion at the beginning, because that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. Now, you know, Joe was able to go fishing for a year because he had enough money in the bank, but he also kept his overhead incredibly low. Mm-hmm. He lived on a canal in Florida, and the house that he bought from his father was $60,000. Yet he's got $2.5 million plumped into his bank account. If somebody's got, you know, $5,000 a month mortgage, it's a different story altogether. So for me, most people are selling because they woke up and decided to sell. They're emotionally tired. It's gotten more to be more of a challenge, and they're not up for it, and they wait too long to sell their business. And they feel like they have to do it just to get out and move on to the next adventure. Smarter, wiser, hopefully with some money in the bank. The smartest entrepreneurs do actually prepare for their exit. They have conversations with advisors, not with other people that don't know what the hell they're talking about. And of course, the smartest ones, 300 a month and counting, read my book. it's all of the information that people need to truly understand the value of their business is out there, but it's not going to happen in one conversation. It's not going to happen in one article. You're not going to gain everything you need by attending one webinar or seminar or weekend event. It's an ongoing learning process. And it should be the most important thing that you focus on, because at least 50% of all the money you're ever going to make from an e-commerce business comes the day that you sell it. Why the hell wouldn't you really focus on that aspect of it? People make it sound like it's easy. That's why. Aggregators say, hey, we buy FBA businesses. We pay all cash and close in 30 days. Avoid the broker fee. They're completely full of you know what, by the way. A lot of them are good people, likable, charming. Remember those things we talked about? Likable, charming, good-looking, well-funded, flatter you to pieces. Those are the ones that are dangerous and you got to look out for, because they're looking out for themselves. The aggregators have done a great job for the FBA world, brought, you know, the exposure up and the multiples up. But let's not forget that they're trying to buy the business at the lowest possible multiple, because that's what they're doing. They're investing. You have to be real careful about what people say and what you believe.
Yeah. So speaking of these aggregators, that's, maybe not specifically the aggregators. How do you see, so you mentioned that we're at the tip of this rocket ship and e-commerce is blowing up, it's growing, right? And the interest from institutional money now, right, aggregators, private equity is coming in the space. What do you see for, I guess, the like you said, nobody, we can't predict the future, but you know, what do you see in the marketplace, whether that's now or in the coming several months? Like what are people, so if they've got, if somebody says, I want to sell this business, I have some time to prepare. Or I'm going to start a business. I want to sell it 2 years from now, whatever. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm really curious about what types of business are in most demand. Are there certain, you know, we talked about Amazon versus non-Amazon, but also sectors, right? Is it, I'm just curious, supplements, is it, what do you see?
If I'm reviewing listings, if I have 100 people call me, and I don't list businesses myself anymore, the team does, but you know, if we had 100 listings that we're reviewing, potentially list, and we could only pick one, meaning we would get the highest value, the most buyers, the quickest time from listing to closing, and working with good people, I would say I want it to be a pet oriented business, primarily, preferably dogs. And I would like there to be some sort of ingestible aspect to it, or recurring revenue aspect to it. Maybe it's, you know, flea shampoo, or a pill that they take to make their coat softer or their breath smell better. But there's recurring revenue to it. It's growing rapidly. There's no hero SKU. I don't want any SKU representing over 50% of the revenue. And I really want them to have a good handle on the lifetime value of a customer. I want them to have a really good handle on the cost per acquisition of that customer. And I want it to be a multi-channel platform. I want them to be selling on their own website. I want them to be selling on Amazon, because most people shop on Amazon. And I think most is an accurate statement these days, 51% at least. And I want them to be doing wholesale, selling to Chewy, selling to other wholesale providers as well. So multiple streams of revenue, so the risk is lower. Recurring revenue, so that income is somewhat predictable. I want them to be at least 24 months old. And I, with that all, I would like it to be a little larger, actually. Let's make it 3 years old and they're doing at least $500,000 in revenue. At that point, that business is going to get multiple offers. And I would say sell for a bare minimum of 5 times. I wouldn't be surprised if it went for 7 times seller's discretionary earnings. And if you don't know the exact detailed the definition of seller's discretionary earnings, you got to look it up. Yeah. So, we sold a similar business to that was only doing $210,000 in discretionary earnings last year, but it sold at a 7x multiple. That is an outlier. That is the biggest multiple in terms of, this is all of discretionary earnings. And it's what I'm talking about in, you know, any e-commerce business. Size does matter. The bigger the business, the lower the risk, the higher the multiple. There's so many variables that go into the valuation process. It's not a matter of, let me give you an example. And I know we're running out of time here, but somebody that owns an agency is doing all the, he's a partial owner of this particular product, sent me an email this morning. Hey, Joe, well, thinking about peeling this one off and selling this brand. What do you think? And he gave me some numbers. And we've sold a business for this person before for over $1 million. And he understands the valuation process. Yet when it comes to selling his, you know, this other one, he's like, yeah, here's the total revenue for the last 12 months. Here's the COGS. Here's the gross profit. Nothing else, no P&L. And the numbers were relatively small. And so I had to ask a lot of questions. The number one was, okay, I'm looking at the site and it looks like there might only be one SKU. What's the situation SKU-wise? Well, there was one SKU doing 99% of the revenue and it's in the supplement space. Huge risk, right? His mindset might be, well, it's only one SKU. It hardly takes any other work. That's fine. You're true. That's true. Buyers are going to be like, it's one SKU. That's a huge risk. There's competition, or there will be, and I'm not going to, you know, put all my eggs in one basket. The other aspects of that business made it untenable. And then on top of it all, what he really wanted was I think it worked out to be a 6x multiple for a single SKU business doing $31,000 in estimated discretionary earnings, selling on Amazon only, and growth is flat for the last 12 months over the previous 12. It's just not realistic. Mm-hmm. So I want people to look out of the future and, you know, if you're going to hope to sell your business someday, you need to get accurate information. And first, yes, reverse engineer a path to that goal, but you also want to know what things are actually selling for, not what somebody said around the, you know, proverbial water cooler, what they sold their business for. I love it when people say, yeah, I sold for 6x. I say, okay. And this is the asshole in me. I say, 6x what? Six times net profit. Okay. Really? Okay. Tell me about that. And then we get down to it. Did you do an ad back schedule? Like, no, I sold to an aggregator. That's what they offered me. So you didn't do an ad back for your cash back money? No. What about your Helium 10 subscription or your Jungle Scout subscription? How much do you pay for that? $500 a month. Okay, $6,000 a year. Do you do an ad back for that? No. These are things that people should be doing. This is the business that they built. It's the most valuable asset that they probably have, but they're believing the hype and not really taking the time to figure out the true value of it and making a lot of mistakes along the way, unfortunately. So I could rant and rail on this all day long, but I know that we've got a window here of time.
Well, I love it. And so for me and those listening, you know, thinking about like this pet supplies or pet products brand, and you mentioned one that sold for that high multiple, you said 200,000 in discretionary earnings. Yep. What's the revenue on that or similar business so that we can have an idea of like, well, okay, is this a,
it's small. So,
two million?
No. So if it's an e-commerce business, if it's 210,000 in discretionary earnings is, you know, maybe on the high side, it's going to be between 15 to 20%, maybe 15 mm-hmm. to 25 right. on the high side. So just call it 20%. So it's doing roughly $1 million, $1.1 million in total revenue to get 210,000 in discretionary earnings.
Wow. That's great. I'm actually surprised that you don't, because I've always heard that the larger the business, the higher the multiple. I didn't realize you could get a high multiple with
$1 million
in revenue.
You're right. And I said it a few minutes ago, the larger the business, the more stable it is. And therefore the lower the risk. And the lower the risk, the higher the multiple. But in this particular niche, this, you know, they had multiple SKUs, multiple channels of revenue and recurring revenue. And when you list something like that in today's world, you get multiple buyers and they push the multiple up to 7x. The average number of offers that we got on every single listing in 2021, 3.77 offers. Mm. 62% sold at or over asking price. And this is the secret here. You price it right, and buyers go after it. You overprice it and they're just going to go, okay, I get the game. I'm going to go in really low. We're going to meet somewhere below what would have been the normal average price. When you price it right, people get interested right away. And then there's a lot of parties looking at it and calls lined up back to back with potential buyers and pressure, if you will. And that's exactly what happened on that smaller business. You are right, though. The larger the business, the more stable, the more secure, the lower the risk, therefore the higher the multiple.
Wow. Last thing on Amazon. So it is interesting that there's so much interest in Amazon these days. I think it's an open discussion. Again, I'm not trying to tell anybody what to do. I think for me, that risk is there, right? They have the on-off button. Mm-hmm. It's not my customer. It's a great way to get quick sales, you know? So like what I encourage people to do is think of it, you know, just don't think that I have an Amazon business, you know? Like that's a sales channel, right?
It is a sales channel.
Right.
But, yeah. I guess it's the way that it's framed in a sentence. We've got to frame it all properly. I have a business and I sell on Amazon.
Yeah, because, you know, like, and again, I'm not trying to disparage anybody. Like, I know people who do really well selling on Amazon. But I think if the words we use, I think matter, mm-hmm. right? Because if you tell yourself, I'm an Amazon seller, or I sell on Amazon, that means that you're not thinking about other opportunities, right? And you kind of blind yourself a little bit.
Or
I think that's my most, I think that's what most irritates me.
Well, or they've really figured out who they are and they're good with, you know, they've got a goal to get this to a certain level and then sell it.
Yeah.
Pay off their debt.
Yeah.
Go RVing for a couple of years or something. You know, you never know their personal individual choices. They may be really good at Amazon, but don't know a damn thing about Shopify, nor did they want to learn or delegate to have that done. You know, there's so much information to grow a business on Amazon these days because of all the quote unquote gurus, and some of them are actually really, really good people. It seems the vibe I get is that the low hanging fruit is still on Amazon versus building your own brand on your own website. I still get that vibe from e-commerce sellers. Now, you're absolutely right that if you are successful with your own brand on your own website, that should trade for a higher multiple because you own the customers. On Amazon, you don't. It should have more value. And it used to be that, you know, a Shopify store, let's just say, call it that, versus an FBA business, the Shopify store is going to, you know, have a multiple that might be 20% higher than an FBA business. But because of the frenzy with the FBA mm-hmm. businesses and all the aggregators, that those multiples have still come up.
Yeah.
If it were me and I had a choice to buy an FBA business that's doing $5 million in revenue or a Shopify store that's doing $5 million in revenue, assuming they had the same product balance and growth trajectories and profits, I could buy a Shopify store all day long because I'd own the customers. It's less risk. There's not going to be an on-off switch though on Amazon. Bezos is not going to turn it off. Let's be realistic about it. You know, the third-party platform sellers generate so much revenue for Amazon. It's a publicly traded company. It's just not going to happen. And the people that, you know, talk about their account being shut down and all this other stuff, there's probably a few people that get caught up in the dragnet. But the rest of the people in that dragnet belong there because they lied, cheated, or stole their way to the top. Mm-hmm. Even the top sellers on Amazon still do it. They use services to, you know, increase their rankings by having people buy their product and submit reviews. It happens every day. And they're going to get caught eventually too. So with time, Amazon is maturing. Right now, you saw the big sweep of shutting down all the Chinese sellers in late Q4. Hundreds of thousands of people sent home because they don't have jobs anymore or something like that. Sad for the people, but the business owners, the quote unquote entrepreneurs in China, were lying and cheating and stealing. Amazon figured it out. That will happen on Amazon as well. I don't know how I got off on this tangent, but yeah, we are actually on the same page. It's, you know, I just see people understand who they are. They build these brands on Amazon, they sell through Amazon, they use the Amazon platform, and then some of them then do go on to other platforms. But why do that first? Why not go to Amazon CA, UK, Germany, Japan, Australia versus building a Shopify store? They already know the Amazon ecosystem. So it's, you know, they take it as far as they can and then they sell. And then, you know, they have that expertise, so they do it again versus going back to Shopify. But if I had to buy one over the other and they were equal in all ways, I'd buy that Shopify store.
Awesome. Yeah. Can't say I disagree with any of that. I think like we talked about earlier, what suits you is what you should do. I want to talk, if you have a couple minutes more, let's talk a little bit about your book that we keep mentioning. And you've been generous to give a copy to our listeners if they would like a free copy. And maybe that's why you're not selling as many as you want. You're giving it away.
I'm helping though. I don't care. You know,
I'm
never going to get rich on book sales, and authors generally don't unless you're Stephen King. Yeah. So if they go to exitpreneur.io/next-level, they can get a free digital copy of the book. They can download it and read it on their Kindle, Nook, iBook, whatever it is that they read it on. And hopefully it's going to have an impact. It's going to help them understand the true value of their business. It's going to help them, whether they sell on their own or use an advisory firm, it's going to help them come to the table with some knowledge and experience. And that first phone call won't be so frightening. There are a few deep dives into ad backs, an entire chapter on ad backs. There's 18 examples of what an ad back is and how it boosts the true value of your business. And there's another deep dive on the intangibles called the four pillars of value. The fifth being the mortar that holds them all together, you, the human. And those are critical. And I find too many people don't pay as much attention to them because it's not math. But let me tell you, you don't do a good job on those four pillars, and instead of a 5.4 multiple, you're going to get a 3.9 multiple. And that is actually math, math that hurts really, really badly. I also go over, you know, the entire process from, I might want to sell my business someday to the, you know, the training and transition after the sale, what happens all along the way, how to negotiate with buyers, different deal points and structures that you want to pay attention to and avoid, the details of an asset purchase agreement and LOI. It's again, I'm not Stephen King. I haven't written a book that's selling millions of copies, but 300 people plus and growing every single month feel like it's worthwhile. And hopefully it's changing their lives for the better and having a real impact on the value of their business and their family's net worth. And hopefully they're sleeping a little bit better at night because they can see somewhat clearly down that road towards that goal versus it being pretty damn foggy.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the name, the Exitpreneur's Playbook, and you've it's you've got it handy right there. I can see it. I don't have to memorize it behind you. So the Exitpreneur's Playbook, yeah. So again, what was that website?
Exitpreneur.io/next-level, and then get a free digital copy of the book.
Yeah, free copy. Awesome. So if you guys are interested, go ahead and check that out. And where can people find you if they want to say hello, get a hold of you, or they're ready to sell or anything at all? Would people?
If they've got a goal set and they want to reverse engineer a path to that goal, even if they're not planning on selling for another 6, 12, 18, 24 months, they should go to quietlight.com/sell and fill out the valuation form. One of our advisors, which are all entrepreneurs turned advisors, will help them understand the value of what they have now and let them know how close or how far they are from those goals. If they want to sell now, then that's what we're there for as well. They can reach me via email at joe@quietlight.com or hit me up on LinkedIn. I'm there. I'm kind of all over social media these days as well.
Awesome. Joe, this has been a lot of fun. Really great kind of all over the place conversation, which is all my just how I like it. So thanks for taking the time with me and the listeners. And let's talk sometime soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it, Isaac.